Chapter 10, Let's Talk Turkey by Willie Snow Etheridge. 10, Off to Ankara. After 9 days in Istanbul, we set off for Ankara to stay with the Honorable George Wadsworth, who was then our ambassador to Turkey. Neither the roommate nor I had ever met Mr. Wadsworth, but we knew Bill Baxter, first secretary of the embassy in Ankara, who, on learning that we were in the country, persuaded the ambassador to have us for a visit. We were terribly pleased about it. Not only would it be enjoyable to stay with the ambassador, but it would be very interesting to see the new capital of Turkey. Until the time of Kemal Atatürk, Istanbul, of course, had been the capital. Ankara had only been a small village on almost a desert plateau near the heart of Anatolia, the Asiatic part of Turkey. Remember, it had been the cradle of the revolution. At the close of the First World War, with Germany and Turkey defeated, the Allies were determined to wipe Turkey practically off the map. They signed a treaty at Sèvres with the representatives of the Sultan, which provided for the British to occupy Istanbul, the Greeks Smyrna, and other Allied countries' other areas, and of course the demolition of the Turkish army. There was no more Ottoman Empire. Indeed, there was scarcely a Turkey. The Sultan assigned Atatürk the task of demobilizing the army. But instead of demobilizing it, he held intact what little remained of it in Anatolia and began patiently to rebuild it. "I will stay in Anatolia," he vowed, "until Turkey has won her independence." The Greeks were the first to meet disaster at his hands. In 1921, a large Greek force landed in Smyrna, not only to occupy this big seacoast city, but to take over whatever they could, get of the fertile coastline of Anatolia. Alas and alack, as the roommate told me succinctly, they got the hell slapped out of them. You remember, I'm sure, if you're old enough, that Greek debacle and the repercussions that followed. Shortly, not only were the Greeks out of Turkey, but all the other Allied armies as well. So Ankara became the symbol of the struggling new land. Also, Ankara's population was very different from the cosmopolitan Istanbul. It was pure Turkish, are as nearly pure as can be found in a country that has absorbed so many peoples through so many centuries, and Atatürk wanted to build a truly nationalistic center. It must be wholly Turkish, and two, it must be Western. Up to that time, the two were incompatible, to say the least. Atatürk determined to change that. The capital would be proof that Turkey could be both. The roommate and I could scarcely wait to see the results. We waked up early the morning of the trip, took first a cab to the Galata Bridge and then a ferry to Haydar Pasha station on the Asiatic side of Istanbul to catch what is recklessly called the Daylight Express. We had first-class tickets, which gave us two seats on an upholstered bench facing a narrow table and another upholstered bench. Only one Turk occupied the other bench, but he couldn't have kept a roommate more uneasy if he had been triplets. Evidently, he wasn't an Orthodox Muslim, for Muslims aren't supposed to drink strong liquor at any time, and certainly not during Ramadan. And this Turk began ordering vodka and lemon squash as soon as the train pulled out of Istanbul. The roommate was positive he would get so drunk before we reached Ankara that he would make a pass at me. But he never did get that drunk. It takes 10 hours to travel to Ankara. The Daylight Express runs, as the saying goes, 3 times a week. When it runs, it does fairly well, considering its puny size. But it stops frequently and stays stopped sufficiently long for the conductor and station agent to make out, sign, and exchange enough pink, yellow, and white paper for an income tax return. The first hours of the trip were beautiful. The train skirted the shores of a body of golden green water that we loved but felt definitely should not be there. Both the roommate and I thought we should be heading directly inland to Ankara, it being 280 miles southeast of Istanbul. Perhaps we had taken the wrong train and we were going to Zonguldak or some other Black Sea port. We wished for a map or for a man who spoke English. Unfortunately, neither was available. Well, shrugged the roommate, it was too late to do anything about it now. We could only enjoy the landscape and trust we would be put off in a non-cannibalistic world. The landscape was lush with growing things. Gold patches of wheat, dark green swatches of swat brushes, bushes that I suspected bore those tons of long, thin eggplant I had seen in the Istanbul vegetable stalls, and yellow acres of beaming sunflowers that would someday cease to beam and become, poor things, cooking oil. But there was nothing attractive about the stations. They were primitive and swarmed with dirty-looking, unshaved, ragged men and boys. Frequently, the boys ran beside the train yelling something, and the passengers handed them old newspapers. Few women were in sight, and those few wore heavy veils over the lower halves of their faces, giving them much more allure than the veiled women of Istanbul. I concluded that the older generation of Turkish women knew what they were up to when they swathed their face in soft, gauzy things. They have never looked so good since. At one side of a station, three veiled women, huddled close together as if frightened, stared wide and big-eyed at the train. They wore loosely gathered together long robes above narrow ankle-length trousers. A magnolia tree in full bloom leaned above them. Toward noon, the roommate grew hungry and growled at me. When do you suppose they eat on this train? Naturally, I didn't know any more than he did, but I said soothingly, I'm sure any minute now. And for once, I seemed to be right. Immediately, the steward came by, handed out menus. They were in Turkish and French, but as the dishes in French were Turkish dishes that we had never heard of, we were as lost as if they had been written in Turkish. Nevertheless, we pondered long and conscientiously over every item and finally decided on our order. Now for the steward. But the steward was now passing out tablecloths. He walked through the car with his arms full and put a cloth folded on each table. We relaxed. He would take our order when he finished delivering the cloths. But no, he next passed out napkins. Later, much later, he appeared with a huge tray of silver and distributed it, three knives and three forks to everybody. Later, salt and pepper shakers. Later, glasses of water. By this time, the roommate was wild. His hopes, which had been so high an hour before when the menus were handed out, were low as a thermometer on a cold day in Kentucky. Were we ever going to eat, or was this fool going to pass out things all day? Next, he came with cups and saucers. Thank God he did bring the saucers with the cups, the roommate snarled. Next, plates. And then, glory be, the bread, very black bread cut in thick slices. The man across the aisle took four slices. Our vodka-drinking friend could not be bothered with any. The roommate and I took one each. When do you suppose we get to order? Asked the roommate again, studying the menu. In a few minutes, I suppose. But again, no. Here came the steward with a huge platter of cold eggplant and green bell peppers stuffed with rice cooked with oil and pine nuts. I liked them, though I think they would have been better hot, but the roommate disliked them emphatically. He said they had a sweetish taste. Then came innumerable tiny lamb chops, no thicker than the soles of shoes, French fried potatoes and slices of tomato and cucumbers, and then cheese and crackers and an assortment of peaches, apricots, plums, and cherries. And, of course, little cups of Turkish coffee. It was very elegant, I thought. I only wish the L&N between Louisville and Atlanta did as well. I'm afraid I dozed a little after this light lunch. After all, I had waked at dawn. But when I again turned my attention to the view outside my window, The rich, gently rolling land of the seacoast was gone, and we had climbed several thousands of feet to reach the sandy plateau that covers a large section of the interior of Anatolia. We no longer doubted that we were on the right train. Though some wheat and grass for sheep and goats grow on the plateau, it became pretty monotonous after a few hours, and I longed for Ankara and for a toothbrush and a hot bath and dinner. My clothes were gritty. My eyes, ears, nose, teeth, and hair were gritty. I began to understand why, before we left Istanbul, the roommate and I could not locate one human being who had made the day trip by train to Ankara. All our friends recommended going by plane or on the night train. What unadventurous people, I had thought. No dare and do in their little souls. No pioneering spirit. I had come to Turkey to see the land, and I would travel by day and by train. And I'm glad I did, but I would never do it again. No place has ever looked so beautiful to me as Ankara, and no man so welcome as Bill Baxter on the station platform. He hurried us into a long, swish, brand new black Cadillac. To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure it was a Cadillac, but all long, swish, brand new black cars are Cadillacs to me, and drove us slowly along the wide, acacia-lined streets of Ankara toward the suburb in which the ambassador lives. All of Ankara that I saw that afternoon is new and modern. The public buildings are fashioned of creamy white stone, and they are huge, plain, and many-windowed. To me, they are neither good nor bad, for modern leaves me indifferent. The grounds about them were well landscaped. Flowers, shrubbery, and trees grow fairly luxuriantly about them and in the parks and along the main avenues. Before Ataturk, the land was barren. There was no water for growing things. In fact, there was scarcely any water for people. Ataturk built a vast dam and irrigation system that not only supplies Ankara, but many of the surrounding villages with water. Having arrived at the embassy, which is a delightful, modern, moderate-sized house temporarily occupied by Mr. Wadsworth while a new embassy is being built and furnished, we were informed by Mademoiselle, who, since the death 2 years ago of Mrs. Wadsworth, looks after guests and the running of the house, that dinner was at 8, a mere 30 minutes away. Madly, the roommate and I, knowing we had to get into evening clothes, began rooting in our bags, throwing things this way and that, which completely undid Mademoiselle and a maid who stood by to unpack us. But there was no time to adjust ourselves to being unpacked. After a lifetime of simple living, we had to do in this pinch what came naturally. Even so, I was not ready at 8 or at 8:15 or at 8:30. I couldn't get the zipper in the back of my evening dress to stay zipped. It was just about to cut my throat when the ambassador, a very clever man who evidently has eyes that see through walls, sent word for me not to fuss myself. There was no rush. Then, of course, the zipper zipped, and I went out into the soft, rosy-hued twilight to join Mr. Wadsworth and his guest in a vine-covered pergola at the end of the garden. I was immediately bewitched by the ambassador, and not because he was my host, either. I have seen hosts I didn't fancy at all, though I was careful not to show it until after I had eaten. But Mr. Wadsworth is a man of forcefulness and charm. He is in his mid-50s with a big, handsome head set on broad shoulders. His eyes are lively and warmly brown. He has an unusual throaty voice and a deep, full chortle. He talks brilliantly on almost any subject and loves to tell anecdotes, yet is a most sympathetic listener. And how I do love a listener. After dinner, I myself was a listener. The men did most of the talking. General W.H. Arnold, head of our military mission in Turkey, was one of the ambassador's guests, so naturally the talk turned to the probability of war and the fighting fitness of the Turkish army. Would there be another world war? The consensus of opinion was no, not likely, not unless we stopped strengthening the military might of the Western democracies and stabilizing their economies. The longer we went without a world war, the better our chances for peace for many, many years, perhaps 20, 30, even 100. If Russia did move into the West or into Yugoslavia, would the Turks fight? Most assuredly, General Arnold declared that not only would they fight, but they would fight magnificently. He said that the Turks accept training in modern arms readily and that their firepower had quadrupled since we began supplying them with arms. The greatest difficulty, the general said, was in teaching them strategic retreat. Their tradition has been to stand and kill or be killed. They neither care nor understand about retreat. When the last guest left and the ambassador bade us good night, we went into his study to pore over State Department documents. Working at night and skipping lunch affairs are two schemes he uses to get his job done. Otherwise, his days would be too short. He usually plays 18 holes of golf every afternoon and bridge every evening. Yet he puts in approximately 8 hours in every 24 on official business. What vigor! Collapsing in bed, I envied him. I scarcely had the energy to draw my eyelids down. End of chapter 10.